Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service, where we report the world, however difficult the issue, however hard to reach. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Five women vying against each other.
Mountaineers who put everything on the line to follow their dreams.
To be the first to climb all 8,000 metre peaks.
The 14 highest mountains.
Amazing sports stories from the BBC World Service presents Chasing Mountains.
Every step was an achievement.
Listen now by searching for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm India Rackerson, and welcome to this bonus episode in the documentary from the BBC World Service. Now, I host the BBC's Lives Less Ordinary podcast, which seeks out extraordinary life experiences from around the world. We're going to bring you an episode of Lives Less Ordinary here whenever we can. But to catch more of our shows, just search for Lives Less Ordinary wherever you find your BBC podcasts.
I googled. What came up is the name of the facility. I couldn't believe it. Really? Is that it? That's it. Yes, I think that's the place. I had these memories that I'd never spoken about, and then here they were. Like everything exploded inside of me. I ran out of the house. I wanted to really scream it from the mountaintops.
In one swift internet search, a spectre from the past flashed through Evie Marguez's head. An image of a pale yellow house standing in the shadow of the snow-capped Austrian Alps, high on the slopes of the Inn River Valley. It's been turned into flats now, but its walls hold a terrible secret, one that was kept from the world and from the children, like Evie here, who lived between them years ago. You're listening to Lives Less Ordinary. I'm India Rackerson. Today's episode, Behind the Locked Door. Evie Marguez is an award-winning photojournalist from Austria, now living in the US. She's been capturing the lives of people with her camera since the 80s, but she spent most of her life keeping a dark chapter of her own story hidden from view, shut away in her mind, too painful to revisit. She even kept it from a therapist who she credits with saving her life. Only now, in her late 50s, is she starting to open up, because this search on the internet a few years ago burst Evie's past wide open, and she had to decide if she could confront it.
Hey, Evie, so lovely to see you. How are you doing?
Hi. Good. I'm a bit nervous.
No, don't be nervous. Don't be nervous. I promise this is going to be very, very relaxed.
Okay. Oh, did it just stop recording?
Oh, did it?
Oh, no. No, it didn't. It just, okay. No. Okay. Oh.
Her nervousness is so clear, but it's so understandable. She's not spoken much about this publicly. And, well, it's destabilizing for her. Evie's in a good place now and happy. But a word here that what she recounts in this conversation about her childhood is distressing. Her early years, even before we get into the story of the yellow house, were turbulent, lonely, difficult. When she was born in Austria in the mid-60s, her mother wasn't married. And like in many places at that time, this was a stain on both the mother and the child. Evie was sent away and placed in and out of foster families, orphanages and children's facilities. Austria holds little to no fond memories for her, and when she moved to the US as an adult, she vowed never to return or utter a word of German again, in an attempt to keep the difficult memories from resurfacing. But something deep in her bones had been keeping the score.
I'm afraid in the dark, so I just keep the lights on at all hours.
As an adult?
Yes, now even. Mm. Like, it's just never dark in my house. So there's always light when I come home. And I have this aversion to yellow. When I was in Innsbruck, every child got a color assigned. And my color was yellow. So the color yellow became kind of like that constant reminder of being there it's a challenge for me to have yellow become my friend. I try to remind myself that it is a color of the sun and of flowers and of light, and just hoping that I get over this aversion.
To try and rewrite the past and take the phobia away, Evie even bought bright yellow sunflowers regularly as an adult. But all that work was eclipsed one day in 2021 when she made a monstrous discovery.
My daughter Lily and her friend were in the house in the afternoon. So they were asking me about my childhood. I forget even what exactly we talked about. You know, parts of my past were not a secret. I was generally pretty open and candid about things. But the part of having been in a mental hospital was a secret because it was so dark and unrelatable, really. Then they went on and did whatever they were doing, going upstairs into her room. And having that fresh on my mind, with hesitation, I Googled Sonnenstrasse in Innsbruck. I've always remembered the addresses generally of my childhood.
And when you looked it up, you saw a word that you'd not seen before.
Yes. What came up is die Kinderbeobachtungsstation, the name of the facility.
What does that mean?
It's the children's observation station. And that rang true. And then I read further. It was kind of like, really? Is that it? That's it. That must be it. And then Dr. Maria Novak Vogel. Yes, I think that's her. I think that's the place.
The Children's Observation Station. This was a new phrase to Evie. She'd never heard it called this before. The image, description, the person who ran it slowly started to resurface in her mind. And there was more, way more. There were detailed reports from other people who'd been there, accounts that struck a chord with her own trauma. Evie started to read them in disbelief. She always thought that the place she'd been sent to had been a therapeutic centre for troubled children, but now she was seeing its whole purpose was much more sinister.
Some of the practices, the way it was described, it was just, it all started to make sense. It was just really extraordinary to have this incredible confirmation that this completely horrible place existed.
And not only did it exist, but it existed for reasons beyond what you had spent decades thinking.
Yes.
And the penny drops of, hang on, this wasn't about taking care of me or correction. It was a mass experiment.
Yes. Yes, it was terrifying. I was so overcome by all this information that I ran out of the house and up and down my block. I couldn't believe it. I hadn't thought about this in so long. I had these memories that I'd never spoken about, and then here they were, and it really, like, everything exploded inside of me. Like, I had to get out. I had to get out into the air. It made me so angry that I wanted to really scream it from the mountaintops. I was immediately confronted with my past in a very profound way, and I immediately accepted the challenge. For me, after decades and decades of holding this shame, I wanted to turn the tables. Once you're confronted with this kind of information, you cannot unhear it or unknow it. You have to deal with it, or it deals with you.
Now she wanted to know, what was this experiment that she'd been part of in this house in Innsbruck? What had they done to her? Evie decided to reach back in time and find out. Before Evie had even stepped foot in the yellow house, she lived with a foster mother called Annie.
Annie didn't like me. She had a bed and breakfast. She was married to Eric. And Annie had, you know, tourists come and stay at her bed and breakfast. And she made it like she was the suffering person with this very difficult child.
How old were you when you arrived at her house?
Four.
Four. Mm. Little.
Yeah.
Little.
Yeah, as far back as I remember, she started accusing me of breaking these things in our house. So I became this difficult child also in the village. On New Year's, you go from house to house and you say a little verse as children. It's a good luck gesture. My foster sister and I did that, and she is the biological child. And people would say, who is the real child? And the real child would get a quarter and I would get like a nickel. Because she was the biological child, so she was worth more. The priest would take me out of school regularly and scold me for being so difficult and giving my mother such a hard time. And I always promised to be better. Or like at church service, he would just put the communion into my mouth and say that I was dirty. Couldn't put it in my hands.
Oh, Evie.
So I didn't have anywhere to go. I didn't have anyone to turn to or to tell anybody anything to. So even when the child welfare services came, I was so afraid. I hid in the closet. I would never, ever have told them how bad things are, because Annie told me that the alternative will be so much worse.
What was their daughter like?
Their daughter was shy and quiet. I was more tomboyish and kind of wilder as a kid. Like, just, I would scrape my knees and like climb trees, and I was just kind of wild.
Why do you think they fostered you? It sounds like they...
I don't know. It's puzzling.
Did you have any warmth? Did you have any friendship in your life?
No, not really. There was my foster aunt who lived in the house above ours. She was sympathetic to me. So that was nice. But it's a small village, so nobody could stop it.
I just find it unbearable, like, hearing that emotional, and there was physical abuse as well, wasn't there?
Yes, there was physical abuse. She would beat me up with like cooking spoons and often accused me of breaking things around the house, like a wobbly chair or some mark on a wall or a dish that was kind of stained. Like, everything was my fault. And she would call me and accuse me of causing this. And when I deny it, she hit me until I admit to it. And eventually, I just started to admit to everything. And often she would lock me in the cellar. But, you know, she would, like, for example, she would lock the toilet and watch me soil myself.
Oh.
And then I have to wash the clothes by hand in the sink.
Oh, Evie.
So there were, like, a lot of psychological kind of torture. It was humiliation.
Did you know that Innsbruck was coming? Did you know that you might be sent away?
No. When Annie got me from this other foster family when I was four, I came with a box of things from my stay there, I guess. And Annie put that box in the attic. And she always pretended to get that box and send me on my way. So I became very afraid of that box. It was always the box. The box became like this symbol of like where I'll be.
That box stayed in the attic. But then one night in late December 1973, aged just 8 years old, without warning, Evie was taken to the Yellow House in Innsbruck.
It felt like middle of the night. It was dark out. and someone came and grabbed me out of my bed. I was in the bottom bunk, and transferred me to a car. And it was dark and it was cold and I was really afraid. But nobody spoke, nobody said anything. And we drove, and we drove for a long time. And I don't remember who was in the car, but I vaguely remember my foster mother, Annie, being there when we arrived in Innsbruck. I was given kind of institution clothing, this big bloomer type underwear, and then a jeans wraparound skirt. I remember the inside of the house of like wood everywhere on the walls, like wood paneling. And there was a big fish tank in the hallway. And we were on the second floor. And there was a large room with a bay window. There were beds stacked on top of each other. They were like these metal cots, and each cot had a color on it to identify whose child goes with which bed. And my color was yellow. I don't remember exactly when I realized it was a mental hospital. I just remember adults in white coats. There was a strong smell of glue, and there was a loudspeaker over the door. During the day, there was just like a lot of shrill sounds. A lot of ringing and alarms. And then to the right was the bathroom. And again, I had a yellow dot on my toothbrush, on my cup, to identify it. And we weren't allowed to talk. And the language that was allowed was abbreviated. So we had to ask permission before we did anything. So for example, we'd have to say, please toothbrush. Or when we ate, you sit at the table and you say, please spoon, before you move to pick up a utensil. So the meal times were downstairs in the dining room. So we would line up in our room on the second floor and then file downstairs into the dining room. And there were big round tables. And there's a supervisor on every table. No talking. And you had to eat what was on your plate.
Any food they left would be presented to them at their next meal, however rotten it became. And pretty much every sadistic element that ruled Evie and the young children's lives was the brainchild of the psychologist who ran the facility, Dr. Maria Novak-Vogel.
She was this very austere woman. She was wearing these large glasses and had a nurse's uniform. And she had her hair tightly tied back in a bun, and she looked very stern. I found out that she's a Nazi-trained doctor and has that ideology. She was an authoritarian. She was obsessed with masturbation and sexuality, and she hated children. But she was revered in Austria. She was considered an expert in child adolescent psychiatry in Austria, and she had close ties to the Austrian welfare system. So there was like this endless supply of children.
Dr. Novak-Vogel had the ultimate say over what happened in the Yellow House. She drew up a list of rules that all the children had to follow.
It's pages long, and it's absurd, and it goes into the minutiae of such things as like checking our underwear for evidence of our bathroom habits. And it's a very intrusive environment. It's, you're being watched, you're being investigated. They want to know your dreams. You have to sit in a room and recount your dreams. So it's nowhere, you can't hide anywhere.
The children just lived in fear. There was zero tolerance for any resistance, and Evie can vividly recall a really disturbing moment when she stepped out of line.
I remember this one time when we were allowed to line up to get something sweet. I was holding up my apron, and they put something into my apron and or my skirt, I don't know, I was holding it up, and I saw ants on me, and I freaked out, and I must have screamed, and I was just lifted up by men in coats and taken outside. And I remember being placed on a cold tile floor and given a shot.
An injection?
Yes.
A shot. These seem to happen quite regularly. But Evie and the other children weren't told why or what they were for, nor, it seems, were any of the parents or guardians. Evie assumed it was just pure punishment. But when she started her research a few years back, she found out something truly shocking. Dr. Novak Fogel had administered strong sedatives, including Rohypnol, to the children, and a strange hormone called epiphizan, an extract from the brains of cattle. When Evie made the decision to journey back to Austria in 2021, she met academics who gave her some clarity on this drug and its alarming purpose.
Epiphizan is given to cows in heat. Well, that's what it was designed for. And it was used by Dr. Maria Novak-Fogel to treat children who masturbated.
What, to suppress sexual feelings in young children?
Yes, she was obsessed.
We were her test objects. She treated us like animals. She drugged us with powerful medicines. It was absolutely shocking to learn this. So she sexualized children.
And as Evie learnt, epiphizan was completely experimental. No one knew what the long-term effects might be on humans. The more that Evie learned about Dr. Novak Fogel, the angrier she became. She found out that the doctor's approach to dealing with problem children seemed to be influenced by the Nazi view of supposed defects being genetically based. Couple that with a very conservative strain of Austrian Catholicism at the time, and it spelt danger for children like Evie.
I learned that her ideologically, it was just remnants from National Socialism. She was deeply Catholic. Being the child of a single mother, I definitely fit that mold of her beliefs that children like I are less than. I met one victim whose mother was Romani. It was really the access that she had to the vulnerable children, to those who really needed support. We were undesirables. We were the outcasts of the society.
Evie was told that Novak Fogel viewed children who wet their bed, masturbated, were left-handed or stuttered as being born bad. She believed that these so-called defective children needed to be corrected rather than cared for. To protect Austrian society, Novak Fogel made it her personal mission to remould these young children into productive, compliant, sexually regular individuals.
Nights were most terrifying, really. So we would lie in bed and the cover came to our armpits and our arms were over the bed to make sure that we didn't touch ourselves.
Just hands away from the body completely.
Yeah. I don't know, it makes me so angry to think about. I was a bedwetter and the mattresses had an alarm built into them that alerted them to when the children wet the bed. So that's how they knew. People in white coats come, take you across the hallway. Then you have to stand in this bathtub and get an ice cold shower as punishment. And then you have to stand in the corner of the hallway where the only light came from this fish tank. It was scary to go to sleep. There was public shaming.
The children had to stand around the bed the next morning of the child that had an accident and humiliate and laugh at the child.
The view of young girls sent to the centre who'd been sexually abused was truly barbaric. They were branded as having personality disorders, seen as responsible for their abuse by seducing the perpetrators. Evie learned that one girl at the Yellow House had accused her father of sexually abusing her, and she was institutionalised as a liar. Though what went on there wasn't advertised widely, it wasn't a total secret. State authorities knew, and Novak Vogel had published papers on her tests with Epiphizan. Evie spoke to experts who helped her build a picture of why all of this was even allowed to go on. She heard that the post-war denazification of Austria was deeply flawed, and some of its ideology just still muddied the waters long into the latter half of the 20th century. Novak Vogel's fixations were part of this, and the vulnerable children of the Yellow House, which she ran for decades, were her guinea pigs.
It was completely shocking to find out that it went on until 1987, and it was incredibly shocking to find out that it affected over 3,650 children. That was really stunning to me because it is such a lonely experience to go through something like that, that it didn't even occur to me that it could have happened to thousands of other children as well.
If you're feeling pretty hooked into this episode and would like to hear more incredible life stories from the people who've lived them, remember to search for Lives Less Ordinary wherever you found this podcast.
Up there, you have to be quick to make decisions because it's not a natural environment for survival.
Five incredible women.
Mountaineers who put everything on the line to follow their dreams.
Amazing sports stories from the BBC World Service tells their story in Chasing Mountains.
I risked my life many times
to be the first to climb all 8,000-meter peaks.
I had to finish it, accomplish it.
Search for amazing sports stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
From the BBC World Service, I'm Indy Rackerson, with the story of Evie Marguez, who in her 50s went in search of the truth about the mysterious institution she'd been sent to as a child back in her native Austria.
It's not like just something that happened to me. It's something that happens across the country.
You must have felt, I mean, you didn't know anyone, I suppose. You knew nobody.
No.
You were totally alone.
Yes. I vaguely remember other kids, but there was no connection. Kids came and went, but you like had no idea what happened. I had this one strong memory of a child jumping out the window. I just remember the aftermath and always wondering what happened to that child.
The Child Observation Station at the Yellow House was allowed to run from 1954 to 1987. That's 33 years. Towards the end of its existence, a director named Kurt Langbein made a documentary for Austrian TV exposing some of its practices to a wider audience.
The exposé happened in 1980. The fact that it went on for another 7 years is shocking. The fact what happened to Kurt Langbein when he did the exposé was shocking. He was about to lose his job and he was going to be banned from Tyrol. That was the response. That's what we are dealing with.
Even after her project was closed down in 1987, Dr. Novak Vogel continued to lecture at universities and was even awarded a medal by the Catholic Church before her death in 1998. It's no surprise that the children under her control might never have questioned these practices.
I really blamed myself for having been placed in Innsbruck to begin with. I think a lot of children tend to do that. I thought it was my fault. I got my childhood records, and they're very detailed in observing each child. And it details how I masturbated. That is why I think
I'm sure I got the Epiphyzan.
How this drug affects a growing child isn't known. But what is clear is the long-lasting impact that Evie's time in the Yellow House and the rest of her turbulent childhood have had on her life. Evie never knew why she'd been sent to the Yellow House in the first place, or why 4 months later she was unexpectedly sent back to live with her foster mother.
When you came out of the Yellow House and were going back to Annie's, how did that feel?
It was terrifying. The same evening at the dinner table, Annie leaned over and pointed at a little knack in the chair and said, "Oh, how did that get there?" And my heart sank. I knew what that meant, that it starts up all over again.
Did you think about telling anyone, talking about what happened to you straight afterwards?
No, I couldn't, because the village was a very kind of Catholic village. So it's like this insulated culture where being the child of a single mother made you the child of a whore, and therefore that's how you were treated.
Hmm.
So everybody knows each other. Like, my foster mother would make sure that everybody knew I was in a mental hospital. So I was really a black sheep. So I couldn't tell anybody, because it was kind of also accepted around me that there was something wrong with me.
Evie had no loving care amidst all the turmoil of her childhood. But when she escaped from under her foster mother's thumb in her late teens, she finally found some comfort and support.
I made my first really great friends, and their names are Jimmy and Andy. And they came back from Vienna, and they're 10 years older than I. And Jimmy drove to Innsbruck with me, like when I was maybe 19.
Wow, you decided to drive there?
We decided to drive there, and I wanted to get my records. I wanted to get an explanation. Huh. Under what conditions did they admit me there? Under what pretense? And I went there, and they just opened their little slider window at the door and closed it. And I didn't try harder. I guess I didn't try harder. After that, it's like trying to live with it. It's like really trying to forget it and not let it be a destructive force in your life.
She tried to lock it away. Evie moved to Vienna to go to university, but then she couldn't face it when she had to go back to Annie's again.
And I just knew I just had to leave. I had to leave.
Yeah.
So then I got this job as a wine steward on a cruise ship.
Mm.
And that's how I left Austria.
You arrived in New York in the 1980s. Had you kind of had an idea that you'd like to get to New York?
No, not at all. I just absolutely loved it.
Oh,
I just absolutely loved it instantly. You know, it was the first place where I felt like you're not judged. Like, everyone has a story.
Hmm. It must be very different to small town Austria.
Very different. Yeah. Intimidating. And it was just like, well, I'm just going to try and stay here for a little while.
Yeah. And you had a gift, didn't you, from your friend Jimmy, a gift that became very important to your life in New York. Tell me about that gift.
Yeah. So Jimmy and Andy came to visit me once in New York, and they gave me a camera. And that became my passion. So I started wandering the streets in New York, and that's how I kind of discovered my love for photojournalism. It's nice to focus on others and focus out in the world and tell other people's stories and try to understand other people's lives and then maybe understand your own more.
Evie had escaped. She had new horizons, new connections, but the abuse was always there in the background.
I think for me personally, it was really the relationship to my own body that was mostly affected. I couldn't really hold or comfort myself. And I developed an eating disorder.
I'm sorry. That's horrid, Evie. That's awful.
Yeah, so
just learning to eat was really a great struggle. I met this really fantastic therapist in New York, and I really credit her with saving my life. I was on a downward spiral with my eating disorder and needed help. Having been at the Kinderbeobachtungsstation, I was never going to seek out the help of a psychologist because of my mistrust against doctors and psychiatry in general. So it took me to my late 20s when I finally was able to go to therapy. I needed somebody to help me put out the fire. I was in crisis. I needed to learn how to be in this world. But I couldn't really go back to the Kinderbeobachtungsstation. To me, it would be incomprehensible for anyone. And I would think there's nothing I can say to really illustrate the horror of that place. Nothing will convey what this place did to me. In the end, it just makes you feel very vulnerable and exposed. And it's not something you talk about because of the deep shame that's associated with it. Because regardless of your circumstances, the other person will make assumptions about you by virtue of just having been in a place like that. And that also ties in with future relationships. Can the person really hold that you have been through something like that?
Her work, new friends, the therapy, all helped. She also began dating, and in 1998, Evie married a fellow reporter, and soon she was pregnant.
I was really afraid that I am like my biological mother, and I won't bond with my baby, and I never understood how she could have walked away. And I was very afraid there would be something wrong with me. I went to New York to have my baby. I was living in Washington, D.C. already, and Sting was performing in Central Park while I was in labor. And it turned into kind of an emergency C-section, about like 12-hour labor. And Sammy is born, and I'm lying there with my arms stretched out because of the C-section. And I'm sobbing, and I can't stop sobbing, and I'm just crying. And the nurse comes over and says, "What's wrong?" Says, "Everything is okay with my baby." And I was just crying. I'm so relieved that I love my baby. So that's like the most amazing memory I have of Sammy being born.
Yeah.
It was just so wonderful. So much love. So, like, I guess when I think of falling in love, like, that's, like, it.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm, like, right there with you. Like, oh, my God, what a huge moment for you.
Huge, like you don't even realize how afraid you are until it kind of like washes away from you.
What of love, of your capacity to love?
Yeah, to feel that love that everybody talks about, that you think like somehow you're broken because you didn't experience that as a child.
Evie's children mean the world to her. In 2021, in that moment when she started to search for answers and discovered the truth behind the yellow house, it was her children who were first to comfort her. Evie was now surrounded by what she had never had, family, as well as another surprise addition.
I got this letter saying somebody claiming to be my sister is looking for me, and I was very excited, and I said, yes, I would like to have contact. And then Barbarella is her name. She's an artist in Zurich. She called, and it was really just this absolutely wonderful person lovely and warm and kind. And she was adopted in Switzerland and grew up just a couple of hours from me. We decided to meet and I flew to Zurich. And I still remember walking from the plane to the kind of pickup area where she was going to come and see me. And I saw her through the glass and we put our hands against the glass and I felt like my insides were on fire. It was amazing to have a blood relative for the first time in my life. And Jimmy and Andy were there and they brought champagne and we sat on the floor and we opened the champagne. We looked at each other. We compared our faces and our height and our body and our hands. And we hugged. And it was wonderful.
Evie's children and her sister Barbarella all went with her when she returned to Austria in search of answers to the horrors of her past. They found out that there was an official commission looking into what went on inside the Yellow House. And Evie submitted a statement.
One day when I was checking my email, I see a note from a Tyrolean official. It is a letter, an official letter of apology. And it said, what happened to you should have never happened. I can only promise to learn from your story. Well, when I was reading these words, I wanted to print it out and carry it around with me. It was really important. It felt like there was an official recognition what happened to so many of us, that it was really now considered wrong and unspeakable. And not long ago, it was considered completely acceptable.
You did eventually meet other victims, mm-hmm. didn't you? You met three of them,
yes,
for lunch. I can't even imagine how that must have felt. What was that like for you?
It was extraordinary to meet these three other women. I've also talked to two men online who have gone through this. And these women were really amazing and strong and have endured so much. And I was going to say their lives were broken by this, but they're also incredibly courageous and strong. But they have suffered greatly from Innsbruck. And it was just amazing to compare memories. It's validating in a sense too that it's like, yeah, that's why this is so hard. Because when you're just by yourself with these memories, it's like, why is this so hard? Why is this so hard to overcome?
But Evie's journey to face her past wasn't over yet. There was still the question of her foster mother. As part of your trip back into the past and your second visit to Austria as an adult, you found out about Annie, your foster mother. You found out that she was still alive and you organised to go and meet her. That's quite the decision to make. Why did you feel meeting her was a good idea? What did you want from that?
You know, I learned that she was still alive. And after learning everything I did about the Kinderbeobachtungsstation and then confronting my history, it felt like it would be really important for me to confront her because she has played such an outsized role in my life. I have had nightmares about her or her house my entire life.
Mm. When you finally meet her, what do you see?
She's surprisingly friendly because I expected more than anything that I will only see her for like 10 seconds and then I'll be thrown out. That was really a surprise. I was ready to confront something really scary. And then you go in and there's like this old lady sitting on the bed, kind of welcoming and happy to see me and to meet my children.
So disorientating for you. What was said? What has stayed with you?
How I didn't challenge anything that she said. Mm. And one of the things that she said is that we both suffered. And why did I not say, how did you suffer, Annie? How did you suffer? Like, I don't understand what she meant by that.
Do you feel angry?
I guess I feel many things. I feel angry, I feel sad, I feel determined.
When she apologises to you, she's crying. She's crying. And you put your hand on her to comfort her.
Yeah. You know, she lived a full life. She's in her 90s. She's in a nice home. I feel like I solicited the apology, you know.
Mm.
She didn't find me to apologize. She didn't initiate any contact or anything.
Mm.
I don't wish her ill. I don't forgive child abusers.
No. Watching your children grow, all three of them, a world away from your experience as an infant and a kid, what was that like for you?
It was extraordinary. It's really the most incredible experience of my life. Each one of them, they're so unique. I'm just so grateful.
Mm.
It's just been such an incredible gift. And to be able to create this family and really community as well has been beautiful.
It sounds like community is quite important to you and your family, isn't it? I think your house is quite famous in the neighbourhood.
Yeah, my house is famous in the neighbourhood.
It's got its own nickname, I believe.
Yeah, my house, I was the house where teenagers hung out. I love kids. And I think having lived in an orphanage came in quite handy.
I have heard that your house has got the nickname of the Wayward Station.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, my friend Kelty calls it that.
I bet you love that. I bet you love that.
Yeah. That's just fine with me.
You did actually go back into the Yellow House on your travels in the last few years.
I did.
That is another extremely brave thing to do. Did you ever think you would walk inside that house again? And what did it feel like when you did?
Never. I was never going to come back to Austria. I was never going to speak German again. And I surely was never going to go back into the Kinderbeobachtungsstation. So it was incredible. It's an apartment building now. But from the outside, when we walked by it, it stirred up some memory.
And you went inside, didn't you? Your children waited outside and you went inside.
Yeah, I went inside. And yeah, it was just extraordinary. It's like going inside the belly of the beast.
Mm.
I didn't see any apartments, but the inside, the staircase was still kind of where it was before. And, you know, I'm feeling differently now than I did a year ago or 2 years ago. It's like, it's really has changed kind of how I feel about things. It just kind of this whole process of unearthing all this feels like has really kind of changed me. I sleep well. I'm more confident. I'm in a good place.
You got hold of a file of some documents in Austria at the time when you went to visit the Yellow House. And it's from a pile of records from around that time. At the bottom of one of these documents, an official had made an assessment. And it said, the minor is courageous enough to assert herself in life. Were they right?
Yes, I guess they were right. I guess they were right.
Evie Marquez, my huge thanks to her for sharing her story. That's all for this episode. I'm India Rackerson. The producer of this episode of Lives Less Ordinary was Edgar Madicott, and our editor was Rebecca Vincent. Remember that normally Lives Less Ordinary won't be in the documentary podcast. So if you'd like to hear more episodes, such as the girl from a trailer park who made it big in Silicon Valley, only to find the unicorn company she was working for was built on a fantasy, then you can search for Lives Less Ordinary wherever you get your BBC podcasts. Thank you.
The mountains are what keeps me motivated in life.
It's where we get to ask ourselves who we are and who we want to become.
At the turn of this century, five mountaineers set out on individual missions to become the first woman to scale all 14 of the world's 8,000ers. 14 mountains, all above 8,000 meters.
It was about pitting themselves against nature rather than each other.
They knew only one of them would succeed. But whether they liked it or not, it would come to be seen as a race.
Five women vying against each other.
The media needed to find some competition, and they find it.
A race with deadly consequences.
We are just not designed to live in this environment.
Getting down alive was my only goal in that situation.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their story in Chasing Mountains.
Every step was an achievement.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.